we're going to talk about is one of the most widespread applications of emphasizing critical barrier pillars today. And just like Dale talked about the Knox Mine disaster in 1959, a catastrophe or a disaster involving a coal mine and a gas well would likely be extremely damaging, not only to the miners that are affected, but also to the industry as a whole. This has been a problem that we've been talking about for well over 100 years. Just down the street from where we're sitting today, in 1914, there was a group of coal and oil and gas operators that got together and decided that they needed to come up with a solution in how mining and oil and gas extraction industries were going to coexist. And this was the quote from that meeting from George Rice, who was the chief engineer from the Bureau of Mines. And he said, undoubtedly, there's a serious problem through the juxtaposition of gas and oil wells in coal mines, not only now, but into the future. And that future that he was talking about is today. And the reason is, this is what the coal reserves look like just south of here in Greene County. So in every longwall panel that you see, there's dozens of gas wells penetrating those coal reserves. And oftentimes, it's those wells that were being drilled even at the time of when George Rice was sitting there. In fact, the picture that you saw in that first slide was the legacy oil and gas wells that were being drilled. So we have two issues. We have the unconventional wells that most of us are familiar with and think about when we think of the vertical wells that penetrate relatively shallow zones. But then we also have today the unconventional gas wells. And these are the ones that are much higher investments for gas well drillers to put in. We're talking anywhere from $7 to $10 million per well for these to be installed. And then once they're installed, they're very difficult to take offline, both in terms of being able to reactivate the well if you need to, but it's a much larger investment and they produce much higher volumes of gas. So the industry has dealt with conventional gas wells mostly by plugging them, but the barriers we're going to talk about today not only affect or applicable to conventional, but if you're going to leave unconventional wells in a state that they could be productive after mining's nearby. The last time there was a major study done on this is 1957. All over the country, we refer to the 57 study. If you go to Kentucky, if you go to West Virginia, if you go to Illinois, they're going to say, we determine our barriers based on the 57 study that came out of Pennsylvania. Again, that was work that at one time was developed right here in Pittsburgh. They had several meetings and came up with recommendations. We'll talk about that. And then most of the talk is going to be about subsidence. Everybody in the room is very used to thinking about subsidence as the vertical component of the ground's response when you have full extraction mining. But there's also a horizontal component that becomes extremely relevant whenever you have ground motions and infrastructure in the ground that's taking place and those beds are shearing. So we'll talk a little bit about that as well. So fortunately, the industry has come together. For those that were here yesterday, heard Steve Schatzel's talk, and he talked about the Pennsylvania technical guidance document to address unconventional gas wells when they're in chain pillars. That's what this is. So this is a case where there's a Marcellus well pad that's situated over top of a series of chain pillars. The guidance that's out there now says that those gas wells will be temporarily plugged. The mining will commence on both sides. Integrity tests will be done to verify that those wells are safe to put back online. And then once that long wall is passed, 1,500 feet past that well, they can again be producing. That document looks something like this. It's available online. You can Google PADP chain pillar technical guidance document, and that'll come up. It is a relatively new document, being that it was finalized in 2021. Now, this is the situation that is unfortunately sometimes more common. So we have guidance out there that says when you mine past a gas well and a chain pillar, that it's going to be plugged. But what is another common circumstance is when you have gas wells near longwall or retreat mining. So in these cases, there has to be a threshold in which it's not necessary for safety to plug that well during the mining process. And what we're going to talk about are some of the factors to consider about when that retreat mining might be too close to the well. These are some of the wells that are being installed in southwestern Pennsylvania today. You can see for those that are trying to compare right now, those are two different well pads. I don't want to ruin the game here. The magic eye that we have up there for you. But two different well pads at different phases of drilling. The one shows while it's in progress, while you have the actual drill rig on site, they're doing that downhole work. And the other one, once the drilling's complete, it looks like a relatively benign pad where you just have these well heads. And this is actually the well head for a Marcellus gas well. Just 2 or 3 months ago, these were mined by in one of the Pittsburgh seam longwall, but the development mining took place. So we see just that little wellhead on the surface. Underground, this is what's actually exists there. So it's a complex series of different casings. You have different protective barriers that are in place, some of which is specifically called coal protective strings here in Pennsylvania. And this construction would look similar if we were looking at a conventional gas well, just a vertical well, or one of these wells for a Marcellus or Utica shale. So this part of it would be applicable to both. And what we're learning is there's a lot of research being done at NIOSH and being supported by the industry to say what is the optimal well construction for trying to sustain ground deformations near longwall mining. And we'll talk in a few slides what that construction technique looks like. But this is what I want to show just to envision these different types of wells. So we just saw the vertical component of the well. This is what it looks like in the ground. And as the industry is evolving, we're finding longer and longer laterals. So that means that the wells that are being installed today are going to be much more critical to be able to keep them online longer. The flows are higher and they sustain higher production over time. So in 2000, 10 years ago, about 2008, 2009, we were seeing 3,000 to 5,000 foot long laterals, and now we're about 4 or 5 times that. These wells are also deeper, so we're talking about higher pressures. And the reason I'm bringing this up is so that we can formulate in our own minds what the hazards could be if these wells were to be breached near our mine atmosphere. So higher pressure, higher volumes, and there's anywhere from 3 to, we've seen proposals with as many as 40 of these wells on individual pads. This is the evolution of the industry. And this isn't a problem unique to southwestern Pennsylvania. This is all over the northern Appalachian coal fields. This shows that between 1,000 to 2,000 wells are being drilled every year within this region. And it's been that way since 2004, whenever the first series of wells were drilled. I can't talk about gas wells and not bring up the 57 study. Every time we sit down with operators anywhere in the country, we're often discussing the validity of the 57 study and how it relates to a particular mining proposal. Here's what I want everyone to take away about the 57 study. The study was done based on about 70 gas wells that were evaluated when they were near retreat mining between 1920. Is that me? No, okay, yeah. Good. I thought it was my feedback. So the 57 study, there's about 77 wells in the database for that. All of them were from mining cases between the 1920s and 1950s. So we're talking about different mining methods. It wasn't full extraction longwall mining. The other thing to take away is, at that time, mining was much, much shallower than what we're seeing. Dale just talked about how Pennsylvania at longwall seams are up to 1,300 feet. The maximum case study in the 57 study was about 650 feet. Okay, so we're twice as deep as any of the case studies, and not anywhere in the 57 study does it talk about miner safety. The intent of the 57 study was to be able to coexist between two industries so that the mining did not permanently damage the gas well. The criteria for failure in that study is, when did the gas well stop producing? It wasn't when did the gas well breach gas into the mine atmosphere. I'm sure that would have been noted if that were the case. It wasn't at what point were there deformations in joints, deformations in casing, deformations in with the well integrity. So that's our criteria in the 57 site. But we saw that the industry implemented it very quickly. The picture on the right-hand side is around 1950. We see an active gas well has about a 50-foot barrier from the retreat mining. The picture on the other side, 1958, when that mining was done, it was a dry hole even then. That means it was not a producing active gas well. And even then, they followed the provisions of the 1957 study for that dry hole. So this was adopted very quickly, and it has been in practice today. And there's some important information that we can glean from that, but it's important to think about what the limitations of any study are. So today, this is the typical mining. I'm not going to stand here and talk about longwall mining at this conference. We'll take a couple things for granted that we all know about. But think about the extraction ratio. Today, we're able, through the efficiency of longwall mining, to do complete extraction of these longwall panels adjacent to the gas wells. Even back in the 1950s, certainly in the 20s, a lot of the support that was being used then were some coal left in the ground to support the top. You didn't have roof bolts even being used at that time for support. So it was timbers, the coal that you leave, and that was about it. So we have full extraction. And what happens whenever that extraction takes place? I said everyone here is used to thinking about subsidence in the vertical component. But there's other mechanisms that haven't been as visible to us because they've all taken place below ground. But the gas wells have certainly been aware of them, because this is the infrastructure being impacted by things like the shear and the compression that takes place near the seam elevation. So Dale talked a lot about pillar stability. Think about a gas well that's being housed within a protective pillar. As that pillar compresses, that gas well could be damaged. We also see, and in the emphasis of NIOSH's research over the last several years, has been what is that bedding plane shift that's going to take place. So this is the horizontal slip that's occurring typically in the areas between very strong and soft layers. So right now the shear that you would see on this is probably most likely to occur at the Uniontown and Swickley coal seams in this particular region. But what we're seeing is that bed in plane slip causing shear on the gas wells. We know that this is an actual hazard because we've seen pressure test results come back after gas wells have been mined adjacent to. So this is the actual pressure test results from one of those wells in northern West Virginia. To make this as simple as we can for this talk, we're going to just say there's two components of this: pressure and time. And what was done here was to see what is the well's integrity after the longwall mining took place. They plugged it while the longwall mining was going by, and then were attempting to re-enter. In both cases, the curves that you see on there represent when that gas well pressure was charged up, and then it immediately bled off in a series of 20 to 30 minutes. It was attempted again. The pressure was charged up, and it bled off in 20 to 30 minutes. And what that tells us is that somewhere, and it was, this gas well was still plugged right underneath the coal seam, But somewhere between the surface and the coal seam, that well structure was breached into the surrounding strata. That would have been the only place that the pressure could have gone. These are two different wells, but it's intended to show the same deformation here. You have a caliper survey results on the left-hand side as we're looking at it. And on the other side, you see the picture of a camera, a downhole camera survey at one of these weak to strong bedding planes where that shear is occurring. So we can see in the camera survey that the types of deformation, we can see on the caliper survey what that looks like. And in some cases, the well casing is able to sustain this much deformation and not be breached. In other times, these deformations might occur very close to a joint in the well, and those are the areas where it's relatively weak and can allow breaching to occur if you see these kinds of deformations. So some of the factors that we want to share that mine operators should be aware of, and I want to put this in context. These are going to be the 8 or 9 different things to help assess whether longwall mining is going to have an impact on a nearby shale well. And I should say this is applicable to unconventional wells, but also if you have conventional with I'll call it more legacy type drilling methods. But the well construction is the one area where for the last 10 years a lot of the industry was focusing on to try to make these wells accept some of this deformation. We've all turned on the radio and we hear the Marcellus Shale Coalition playing the advertisements about 6 well casings and they're all fully cemented to surface to protect everything. Well, what we're finding out is those fully cemented well casings, whenever you have shifts in the overburden, the impact on that well, particularly the production strength, is an order of magnitude higher than if you were to leave just the annulus around the production string open. So a lot of the discussions in the industry now emphasizes of using how critical the construction records are for these gas wells. If you have a reserves and there is active drilling going on in those reserves, it is absolutely critical to make sure the gas well operator is taking and recording exactly how those wells are being constructed. 3 times over the last 2 years, we've seen well records come in that say one thing, and then after some questioning or after the state ends up pursuing some additional records, we find that the casing might be different, the cement behind the production string or within these annulus are different. So we need to make sure that the information that you're using for assessing this risk is accurate. We've seen a lot of different information coming in related to the well construction. But for this, if there is an uncemented annulus, that well is going to be able to be able to accept some of those deformations. This one goes without saying, but the distance to the longwall gob is going to be very critical. The closer you are to the gob, the more likely you're going to see these deformations. What's interesting is that we often talk about this in terms of angle of draw for longwall mining, but the types of deformation we're talking about on the bedding planes, it can often extend much further than what we typically think about the zone of subsidence type influences. So the closer you are to the longwall gob, obviously the more susceptible that well will be. The angle support is almost the inverse of what we think about for the angle of draw. So the angle of support, like I said, there were some good, very relevant points in that 1957 study. This angle of support is one of them. So this says that once the tangent of 8 degrees was achieved underground at that barrier distance, that those wells in the 1957 study did not experience any potential failure. So the angle of support goes back to and is one factor in what we recommend evaluating for those risks. There's a little bit of interesting information here too when we talk about the topography and the depth of the coal seam. For those that were here during NIOSH's presentations yesterday, we saw this when Steve Schatzel was presenting, and what they found in their research is the wells that are shallow are often experiencing higher degrees of deformation than the wells that are deeper. And that might not be intuitive to everyone in the room. So the deeper the coal seam is to the surface, that subsidence, the cave-in, the fracturing and the slip, is going to be controlled by the confinement that's available to mobilize or demobilize those bed implants. So the barrier pillar itself is going to need to be designed to sustain higher vertical loads. But when we think about the impacts on the gas well, shallower actually means you're going to see higher degrees of slip between those bed implants. We talked about ACPS. What's awesome about the new software that's out on the University of Kentucky website is that you can model all kinds of different geometries that we never could before with programs such as ORMS. Dale's presentation on Crandall Canyon showed that it could be used to evaluate complex barrier geometries. We've used it in all kinds of different configurations to be able to look at pillar system stability for protective gas well pillars. And the recommended criteria here, as with any long-term application, is 2.0 stability factor for the barriers. We talked about our normal minimum. The last presentation is 1.5. But whenever the barriers need to sustain, are critically important for mine safety, but then also sustain that load for a much longer term, that's why we recommend the higher stability factors. The other criteria here is really to ensure that pillar isn't going to deform. When you saw the different failure mechanisms before, there was one that associated with compression of the pillar. What we want is to make sure that it's a squat pillar that has a mechanism that's going to allow to continue to accept load, that you don't have much deformation at the center of that pillar. So we're looking for wide protective pillars with width to height ratios greater than 12. So there's a lot more. It's tough for a roof control guy to stand up here and not make it sound like the only thing you need to worry about with gas wells is pillar stability, right? Because that's the beauty of the sometimes narrow world that we're involved in. There's often, and we collaborate on every one of these with the ventilation division and tech support, as well as NIOSH's ventilation researchers and their fire and explosions branch. But there's a lot of other things that we've learned along the way that I wanted to pass along. What's critical is recognizing that there's a lot of other sources of gas that exist other than just the producing zone. The one thing that we've seen is that there's anywhere from a dozen to 20 different gas producing zones that might exist beneath some of these intermediate basins. Also, there's underground storage fields. I don't think I'm exaggerating when I say in 2 to 3 years, most of the longwall mines in northern Appalachia will have at least one underground storage field that they're operating above. These storage fields present a lot of different issues that could, I should say, a lot of different potentials as far as gas sources if you were to encounter one of a legacy type of well but it's just one more source of gas that if you temporarily plug just the Marcellus or Utica, that you could have going through the annulus of these other casings. We've seen a lot of wells that outside of the production string, there's annular pressure. So if you're evaluating the risk of a gas well, and even if it's going to be temporarily plugged to the producing horizon, it's also worthwhile to understand what and from where is any gas that's in the annulus of these other casings. So that's gas that might be present outside of the production string. I can't emphasize enough just how varied some of the construction records are, but the most surprising thing to me has been how different wells could be even on the same pad. So you can't look at just one of these wells among 3, 4, 5, 6 and think that it represents the construction of every well on the pad. We've seen wells with not only different depths of particular casings, we've seen wells that have also emitted certain casing on certain wells and used it on another. We've seen cases where the cementin has been completely different on even adjacent gas wells. So don't look at one well on a pad and assume that that well construction is uniform across all the others. So the mining industry in 2023 has a lot of unique challenges to solve that many generations before didn't have to think about in terms of the magnitude of what could happen. But these are not new problems on the surface. These industries have had to coexist for over 100 years now, and they've done so in most cases safely. So we want to emphasize that as we're moving into the future, we don't want to take a step back. I showed in one case in the 1950s, they even had gone from a 50-foot barrier around an active well to a 200-foot barrier around a dry hole. And so we see the industry recognizing hazards and taking the appropriate steps, and we wanted to provide some resources available for you to do that. So in 2019, my colleague, Dr. Chris Mark, and I had put together a paper. It goes over each of these factors that I just talked about in a risk matrix format. And it helps assess the likelihood of an interaction with that gas well. So all of the factors that I talked about in this presentation are in that paper. They're rated low, medium, high. How far from the longwall gob? What's the angle of support? You could work down through that and using a qualitative assessment determine the risk associated with the mining to impact a nearby gas well. So I'd recommend this is a technique that we've still found useful today. We're continuing to learn more with the research of NIOSH on characterizing the consequence of an interaction with a gas well, but this paper is going to focus on the likelihood that the mining will impact that well. With that, here's my email. Like Dale said, we love talking about this stuff. We're happy to reach out and work with you if you're evaluating a particular pillar design, if you want to talk about forward-looking plans for wells in your reserves, if you want to talk about what the plan's going to be for designating protective pillar sizes, we're happy to talk. And with that, I will open up for any questions. Sir. Can you say that one more time? Hey. Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. That's an awesome question. In fact, that is one of the factors on the risk matrix that I didn't talk about during this talk. So the question was, we talk a lot about mining past wells. So what happens if there's drilling behind mining, right? The long-term risk, if there's a abandoned mine or a sealed area, what are the risks with drilling into those areas behind mining? That's where we'd love to see most of it, because most of the ground control risks are mitigated in that situation. You don't have to worry about what's going to be the long-term impact or you know, the magnitude of things like subsidence are largely controlled at that point. The plans that we, how do I want to phrase this? The recommendations that we've had whenever we're looking at those situations, the risk to miners when drilling takes place behind mining is mostly with the drilling methods itself. If we think back about 2018, you could probably get about any year, there is a lot of evidence in the news about whenever fracking can go wrong. And we see cases whenever the actual well construction, the hydraulic fracturing, can then do the damage to the well at that point. What we like to see in plans is communication. We like to see that as that the initial casings are penetrating the coal seam, that the mine's evacuated. So in case that well does penetrate somewhere other than the protective pillar, what we like to see in those plans is a communication network between the gas well operator during hydraulic fracturing. If there's any issues, if there's pressure drops, if there's unexplained feedback on those drill rigs while they're drilling, that gets communicated to the mine operator. Because what we've seen is if these wells, during the fracturing process, if these wells breach up higher, it's going to hydraulically frack everything in that overburden. So without deep diving into specific cases, the main risk is while that drilling's taking place. Yeah. And I can't forget, I'm forgetting the name of the wells I want to reference right now, so you probably got off easy on it. It really is. We don't want that well to breach during and then that be able to impact the mine atmosphere. And fortunately, where the most significant events have occurred, they've been outside of active mining areas, but certainly not outside of all historical coal mining regions. They've happened in Pennsylvania and others. Sir? No. A question, are we more concerned about Marcellus than Utica? And we've actually, we're very concerned with both. The reason I probably used Marcellus during this talk is just because that's the most common that we're seeing. The same issues, the same risk, and even very similar construction methods would be used for Utica wells. So unless you, in terms of what's going to be penetrating the coal seam, so whether it's Marcellus or Utica, again, this, the guidance we have in this paper would be applicable, because it's that, you know, what's going on from the coal seam, just below the coal seam and then above it is what we're concerned about. Awesome. Appreciate it. Thanks for sticking around too.
Thanks, Greg. Well, this concludes the U.S. Coal Show 2023. Hope you enjoyed yourself. Hope you found value in what we did. We will return in June of 2025. Thank you.